Elizabeth Lesser is co-founder of the Omega Institute and best-selling author of Broken Open and Marrow. Her most recent book, Cassandra Speaks, asks a simple question. What if women were allowed to tell the stories that shape our world? In her re-examination of our origin stories, myths, and ancient texts, Elizabeth asks women to trust their instincts, speak their truths, and reclaim their authentic voices, and asks both women and men to reimagine a world where the language we use values caretaking and communication over vengeance and violence. The name of the book is Cassandra Speaks: When Women Are the Storytellers, the Human Story Changes. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Elizabeth Lesser back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joe.
What brought you to this particular topic?
Well, you could say my whole life brought me to it. It's my fourth book, but on many levels I've been wanting to write it ever since I was a teenager, let's say. I was the second daughter of four daughters with a domineering-type father, highly creative and very domineering father, and a mother who took a back seat. And for some reason, ever since I was a kid, I've never figured out why, I was like the dissenter in the family, the daughter who was like, wait a second, there's five of us women and one of you, why don't we get a say in what's going on here? And then I went to college and, you know, the time when feminism was really rising, and I became a co-founder of an organization that was me and mostly other men who were running it. And it seems like my whole life I've been looking at this question of what is it about women that has led to us not being trusted in realms of power or even just in everyday life. And I wanted to go back and look at these old stories that still live in the DNA of our culture and of our families and our bodies of you know, what are the stories we've told about women and men and war and sex and power and love, and are they still influencing us?
So you go back to Eve, you start there.
Yeah, it's a good place to start because it's really our first origin story, and I'm talking about Western culture. I did do a lot of looking into other cultures, too, and it's amazing the similarities of many of the origin stories that pit women as second born but first to sin. She's responsible, blamed for the ills of the world, whether it's Eve or Pandora or women in other cultures. She was born second, and she sinned first. So I wanted to really look into that story of Eve, other translations, other interpretations, my own interpretation.
And what do you feel that you found that you understand through your interpretation?
Well, I've always been really fascinated with the hero's journey. You know, Joseph Campbell, his reading into myths from around the world, this idea that the hero is someone who wants to understand life, is curious, and knows that perhaps he has to leave home and leave what's known and leave the status quo, even if he's risking everything and he takes a journey and he's exiled and he quote-unquote finds himself and then he returns. And that's the journey of the hero, the journey of maturity, of wisdom. And as I was rereading the Bible, the Greek myths, many other stories, I realized that Eve actually was the first person in the Bible to take that hero's journey. She wanted wisdom. She ate the apple because it was promised to make her wise. She had to, therefore, leave the garden of childhood and go out into the world in order to understand it. And if Eve had been a man, like let's say Noah or Job or Jesus, these are all figures in the Bible who bucked the status quo and found wisdom. But Eve's the only protagonist who's punished for her curiosity. Mm. Like curiosity and women always in these myths is bad. It's something, you know, women should not be curious. They should just stay in their lane and leave the hero's journey up to the man. So I kind of see Eve as our first grown-up, but, and if she had told the story, that's what it would have been told as.
You say, regarding Eve, it's good to contemplate what our culture would be like if the first woman had not been branded as second-born, first to sin. How would things be different if humankind's first big mistake wasn't to follow the lead of the woman?
Well, if you brand a whole group of people, and that's what myths do, they're not just the story of one person, they become the story of groups of people. So if you brand all of women second born and first to sin, then over millennia, anything associated with women is assigned a lower cultural value. Because why would you trust what this group values if they're to be blamed for the problems of the world? I mean, Eve brought everything into the world that wasn't there before. I mean, before she came along, everything was wonderful in the Garden of Eden. There was no illness. There wasn't even death. She brought all of that on. So why would you trust her and her children and sisters? So over the years, everything like caring for the children, caring for older people, talking things out, listening, tending to the emotional health of a community, all of those were seen as like kind of soft, kind of like, you know, good for the elementary school teacher or the nurse, but like that's not what power and leadership is about. So I do think that if Eve had been honored the way other protagonist heroes had been honored, our culture would honor relational, connected, vulnerable, empathetic ways of being. And I go as far as thinking we wouldn't rely on violence to solve our problems as much.
You write about Cassandra. The title of the book, of course, is Cassandra Speaks. And in writing about the Greek myth, you say that her story resonates so clearly with our times. She could foresee the future, yet her words fell flat. She was disbelieved, disregarded, and gaslighted. That's a great way of putting it, especially the gaslighted part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gaslight is a word that I had kind of heard a bunch before I started writing the book, and I never quite knew what it meant. I had to keep checking, but I became very familiar with it as I was writing the book because I didn't know I was going to call the book Cassandra Speaks until I was almost done with it. And as I was writing, the Me Too movement was really blossoming. I mean, so much has happened in the past 2 years. The Me Too movement almost feels like ancient quaint history.
Right.
But so gaslight is really the story of Cassandra, where you know what's true in your bones. You know what's happening, but so many times you're told you're either crazy, overreacting, hysterical, that you begin to doubt yourself. You begin to think you're crazy, and that's what gaslighting means. And Cassandra, being a princess who received a gift from the gods, clairvoyance, but then when she refused the god Apollo's sexual advances, he was so angry at her, he left her gift, clairvoyance, but he put a curse on her. Yeah, you're going to see into the future. You're going to know what our land needs, but no one will believe you. And she eventually went mad from, like, predicting the Trojan War, all of her family dying, the city in ruins. She would see it. She knew the repercussions of what would happen if they went to war, if they did this and that, but she wasn't believed. And, you know, you look at so much of what's happened over the past years with women telling their stories, whether it's the girls who spoke out against Dr. Nasser, mm-hmm. The gymnasts, the Olympic teams who were being abused by him year after year. They told their parents, they told their universities, they told the Olympic Committee. Nobody believed them. And when they went to trial and were allowed to tell their stories, story after story was a Cassandra story. They were told they were hysterical and overreacting. And I relate to that as an everyday girl and woman. Knowing some things that seem completely right and true to me, but not even believing myself, because we have, for so many years, women have been told that we're emotionally overreacting.
And also with Cassandra, she's predicting the future and they're not believing that. And in the case of these young girls, they are in some way even predicting their own future since they're not being believed.
Exactly. That's so, I've never thought of it that way. That's really beautifully said. They knew what happened in the past. Even that, even a story that literally happened, is not believed.
In the book, in looking at these stories, I do also want to mention Pandora, which you write about as well. Why is that significant?
Well, Pandora also was the first woman in the Greek, ancient Greek religion, ancient Greek mythology. She was given to mankind by the gods as a gift, but they gave her all sorts of qualities that were frowned upon, like curiosity again. She was very curious, which in a woman wasn't good. And they sent her down to mankind where there were no women. It was just men. It was like a frat party. Everybody was having a really great time. And then Pandora came. And Zeus sent her down with a jar. We call it Pandora's box, but it was actually a jar. And she was told, don't open the jar. Don't peek in there. But as the story goes, and this is one story, when I went back and looked at other interpretations, many said, actually, she didn't open it. She found it open. But in any event, as the story we know goes, she got too curious for her own good. She opened the jar that Zeus had said, don't open. And into this perfect world flew out everything that mankind now is plagued by: illness, competition, greed, even death. There was no death before she opened the jar. But just in time, she shut it very quickly. This is a part of the story that's never told, even though it is told by Ovid and others. She shut it just in time to leave one of the spirits in, and that's the spirit of hope. Elpis, the spirit of hope. So I like to think of Pandora in one of the interpretations where she found the jar open on the floor and she shut it just in time so that us humans would have hope to fall back on when things are really rough. And of course, I've been calling on Pandora a lot recently because I just need hope these days. Like if I fall into the trap of despair that we're not going to make it through this time, through the multiple pandemics of our time, I become very unhelpful to everyone. So I like to call on Pandora and the spirit of hope.
The name of the new book is Cassandra Speaks: When Women Are the Storytellers, the Human Story Changes. The first part of the book is origin stories, and the second part is power stories. Talk a little bit about the power and where that comes from.
Yeah, well, I use a lot of my own stories in the book because, of course, I think we all know how it's stories, how we learn. We love stories. Humans love stories. And, you know, I have figured out as an author that the more I tell my own story, the more people kind of perk up, because we love to learn through other people's stories. So I use a lot of my own stories. And one of the stories I tell is going into the basement of my house to do some cleanup and finding a box, and of course never cleaning up the basement because I just got lost in the books from a class in one of my son's college curriculum. And it was about the books that have informed how humans relate to power over the years. So it's like Sun Tzu and Machiavelli and books like that. And I was naively shocked to find out that all the things we think of as the abuse of power, dominance and using fear and war to control people, actually are written in to the texts of power. I had never read The Art of War. I had never read Machiavelli's The Prince. And I got lost in this box of books that have actually trained us in business and government, even in families, what we think power is: domination over other people, using fear, the threat of violence, violence itself. And I don't think that's how power has to be. So the second part of the book explores other ways of defining power and using power, and the hope that should women become more and more powerful, that we don't just repeat the history of the abuse of power, that we actually figure out a way to do power differently. And I think women are poised to do that because we've been power outsiders for so long.
So how do we do that, and how do women do that in a way that is suitable for all? And I ask the question because as I'm talking to you, above me is a monitor and the Amy Coney Barrett hearings are on.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
I'm watching a conservative woman talk about her vision, although she's not saying a lot, but the vision of the Supreme Court.
Well, this is the most important question, and I'm really glad you asked it. And in these politically correct times, a lot of people are afraid to ask that question. So thank you for asking it. You know, women are not some monolithic block of everyone the same, just like men aren't. And I know so many men who relate to being gaslit and not wanting to use power the way it's been traditionally used. So in many ways, you could say what I'm talking about is people who want to disrupt the patriarchal ways of seeing not just men and women, but society, culture, power, violence, dominance. And there are many, many men, and I would imagine you are one of them, Joe, who would be like, yeah, me too, I'm in. So there are many women who, for whatever reason, are going to uphold the old ways. Someone like, who, you know, what we're watching right now with the Supreme Court, this is what she believes in a deep way. These are her values. But just because these are her values doesn't mean she's wrong and I'm right. There is a way for multiple values to live together. We're going to always have differences of opinion. You know, us liberals, I'm speaking for myself, love to think that diversity is good. You know, like, we're not racist, we're not homophobic. But one thing that we are for sure is we're very intolerant of other people's values and opinions. And I believe that if women and men begin to do power differently, it's not that we're all going to agree, but it's that we're going to learn to live together and meld our values into something even better than if we all agreed, that we'll learn from each other and we'll communicate with each other and we'll find a way to get along within the grand diversity of thinking.
So toward the end of the book, and you quote Toni Morrison throughout the book, but there is a section, a chapter on dream. So what is your dream?
Well, my dream is sort of what I just said. My dream is that, like Eve, we will seek wisdom, not domination. Each one of us will seek wisdom in our own life, women, men. And to me, wisdom means the capacity to be bigger than our own tiny, grasping, fearful ego, that will look beyond the confines of our personal needs. And will, you know, there's this idea that the only response to crisis is fight or flight, but that actually isn't true. When women were put into the studies about how do humans deal with trauma, they came up with this phrase, tend and befriend. So my dream is that under these trying times, we will instinctually want to tend and befriend more than fight and flight.
The name of the book is Cassandra Speaks, When Women Are the Storytellers, The Human Story Changes. Elizabeth Lesser is the co-founder of Omega Institute and the author of Marrow, The Seeker's Guide, Broken Open, and again, the new book, Cassandra Speaks. Elizabeth, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thanks, Joe.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Cassandra Speaks. The book is published by Harper Wave. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.